1962, Taylor took over as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He found the chiefs still embittered over what they regarded as Kennedy's unfair criticism in the wake of the Bay of Pigs, engaged in ongoing battles with civilian officials in the Office of Secretary of Defense. The chiefs saw Taylor's selection as the imposition of a Kennedy man on an organization designed by law to give impartial military advice to the commander-in-chief. Taylor quickly cultivated a warm relationship with the man whom many of the military officers in the Pentagon deeply resented. Taylor and McNamara found common ground in their belief in the need for administrative reform in the Pentagon, faith in the flexible response strategy, and utter devotion to their commander-in-chief. Like McNamara, Taylor concluded that the answer to problems of service rivalry and administrative inefficiency was increased centralization of power in the chairmanship and in the Office of Secretary of Defense. Taylor had once lamented the indecisiveness of Eisenhower's defense secretaries, and he lauded McNamara for tackling the tough problems of the department. The bond of respect between the two men was mutual. McNamara considered Taylor one of the wisest, most intelligent military men ever to serve. Much to the chagrin of the other chiefs, Taylor and McNamara formed a partnership. Taylor's overwhelming influence with the Secretary of Defense and the President made opposition to his views futile. Historian Robert Devine observed that Vietnam can only be understood in relation to the Cold War. Indeed, Cold War crises during Kennedy's first months as president shaped advisory relationships within his administration and influenced his foreign policy decisions until his assassination in November 1963. Already predisposed to distrust the senior military officers he had inherited from the Eisenhower administration, the Bay of Pigs incident and Laotian crisis motivated the president to seek a changing of the guard in the Pentagon. After the Bay of Pigs, an unsatisfactory diplomatic settlement in Laos, confrontation with the Kremlin over divided Berlin, and Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev's bullying rhetoric persuaded Kennedy that the United States needed to make its power credible, Vietnam, Kennedy concluded, is the place. Vietnam, however, loomed in the background while the new frontiersmen confronted in the Caribbean what would become the best known of Kennedy's Cold War crises. Chapter 2, Havana and Hanoi, October 1962 to November 1963. McNamara has proved a real find. Under the leadership of McNamara and his band in the Defense Department, the country has markedly improved its capacity to fight both conventional and unconventional wars. No less important, McNamara has asserted the authority of the civilian Secretary of Defense over the entire military establishment. In an era when Americans are growing alarmed by the rise of the garrison state, McNamara's achievement may well stand out as the most important development of the Kennedy era. William E. Luchtenberg, 1963. On Taylor's first day as JCS chairman, he and his colleagues heard an intelligence briefing about the possibility that Soviet ballistic missiles were in Cuba. With the exception of Director of Central Intelligence John McCone and some mid-level analysts, however, the administration dismissed the possibility. With an eye toward the impending congressional midterm elections, the president wanted to keep Cuba out of the limelight. The Bay of Pigs had left Kennedy and his Democratic Party vulnerable to accusations that they were soft on communism. Critics charged the young president with naivete, and in a reference to the title of his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, asserted that Kennedy was all profile and no courage. Republican Senator Kenneth Keating of New York cited reports of Soviet technicians and anti-aircraft missiles entering Cuba and attacked Kennedy as a do-nothing president. To defuse such criticisms, the administration took the public stance that the Soviet buildup in Cuba was defensive. Afraid of leaks, the president limited intelligence that indicated otherwise to the small circle of his most trusted advisors. On October 11, 1962, when Director of Central Intelligence McCone brought Kennedy photographs of large crates thought to be Soviet-made IL-28 bombers, Kennedy asked that the information be withheld at least until after the election. In fact, Kennedy was obsessed with Cuba and Fidel Castro. His administration was hard at work on a covert program, codenamed Mongoose, to undermine the Cuban government, incite insurrection, and assassinate Castro. He viewed Castro as a reminder of the Bay of Pigs humiliation. In November 1961, Attorney General Robert Kennedy told the special group charged with getting rid of Castro that the Cuban problem carries top priority in the U.S. government, promising that no time, money, effort, or manpower is to be spared. While the CIA planned to assassinate Castro and foment insurrection, the JCS planned a full-scale invasion of the island. Each of the services conducted extensive rehearsals for the invasion. The largest, Operation Swift Strike, involved more than 70,000 men. In October 1962, as the Joint Chiefs refined their plans, Soviet soldiers, advisors, and military equipment poured into the island nation. As evidence of the presence of Soviet missiles in Cuba mounted, McNamara encouraged the JCS to plan not only for the destruction of the missiles, but also for Castro's removal from power. The chiefs, for their part, urged McNamara to gain Kennedy's approval for U-2 surveillance flights over Cuba to gain information about troop dispositions, landing beaches, airfields, and surface-to-air missile or SAM sites. Permission for the overflights, however, was not immediately forthcoming. The Joint Chiefs had grown frustrated with what they regarded as the White House's obsession with the potential political costs of losing a surveillance aircraft over Cuba. Dean Rusk predicted an outcry from allies in the Americas and the United Nations. In deference to Rusk's concerns, the president authorized flights no closer than 25 miles from Cuba's shoreline. These peripheral reconnaissance missions were ineffective, as distance and camera angle blurred photos beyond utility. Meanwhile, agent reports of Soviet missiles in Cuba began to arrive in Washington. Finally, Kennedy authorized a U-2 overflight for October 14th. As the administration sought confirmation of the missile sightings, the JCS edged toward a war footing, recommending mobilization of the 150,000 reserves that Congress had authorized several weeks earlier. The Air Force moved fighter aircraft to Florida and began stockpiling bombs, ammunition, and other supplies needed for attack. After reviewing the U-2 photographs of the missiles on October 14th, the Joint Chiefs thought military action against Cuba a certainty. They recommended a powerful airstrike to destroy all significant military targets, a naval blockade to isolate Castro from outside support, and an invasion to ensure the eradication of the missile threat and the removal of Castro from power. On October 15th, after the National Photographic Interpretation Center developed and studied the U-2 photographs, Kennedy gathered his most trusted advisors to analyze the situation and formulate a response to this challenge to U.S. national security. These men formed the Executive Committee, or EXCOM, of the National Security Council and deliberated secretly to weigh political and military options. EXCOM included Attorney General Robert Kennedy, Secretary of State Rusk, Secretary of Defense McNamara, Director of Central Intelligence McCone, Secretary of the Treasury Douglas Dillon, Special Assistant for National Security Affairs Bundy, Special Counsel Theodore Sorensen, Undersecretary of State George Ball, Deputy Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs U. Alexis Johnson, Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs, Edwin Martin, Soviet expert Llewellyn Thompson, Deputy Secretary of Defense Roswell Gilpatrick, Assistant Secretary of Defense for ISA NHTSA, and JCS Chairman Taylor. Although the group included McNamara's deputy and principal operational planner from OSD, Taylor was the only professional military officer who attended the meetings. On October 16th, McNamara offered an alternative to the chief's recommendations for a full-scale airstrike, blockade, and invasion. He argued that the XCOM had focused on a false choice between the all-out military solution and an exclusive reliance on diplomatic pressures. McNamara suggested that the United States blockade Cuba to search approaching ships and remove offensive weapons. The defense secretary based his third category of action on overt military action of varying degrees of intensity, including a naval quarantine, aerial overflights of the Caribbean island, and the mobilization of a large military force. McNamara was confident and articulate. He set the agenda for the discussions, persuading the XCOM with what seemed reasoned judgment and cogent analysis. Although the president's advisors had initially favored offensive military action against Cuba, a consensus soon formed around McNamara's proposal. In an evening meeting on October 18th, President Kennedy told his advisors that he had rejected the first strike option in favor of the blockade. The JCS resented being excluded from the XCOM meetings. Every evening during the crisis, Taylor found the chiefs anxiously awaiting his return from the White House. They grilled him to ensure that he had accurately represented their recommendation to bomb the missile sites and follow the airstrike quickly with a ground invasion of Cuba. Taylor requested that Kennedy invite the Joint Chiefs to the White House to allay their agitation over not being consulted directly. Having absorbed much of the blame for the Bay of Pigs, the chiefs wanted to make unambiguous their position on the level of force required. The decision in favor of a naval quarantine of Cuba, however, had already been made, and the president's October 19th meeting with the chiefs was designed to keep them from opposing his decision rather than to solicit their advice. At the beginning of his meeting with the JCS, Kennedy suggested that an air and ground offensive against Cuba would alienate U.S. allies in Europe and precipitate Soviet retaliatory action against Berlin. The chiefs, however, argued that a failure to act decisively in Cuba was even more likely to embolden the Soviets in Berlin and elsewhere. LeMay told the president repeatedly that he did not see any other solution than direct military action. He argued that the blockade option would be almost as bad as the appeasement of Hitler at Munich, and, he suggested, would encourage further Soviet aggression and result in the United States gradually drifting into war under unfavorable conditions. LeMay declared that if the president took strong action, the Soviets would be forced to back down and would not respond in Berlin or anywhere else. The other chiefs reinforced LeMay's argument, describing a surprise airstrike, blockade, and invasion as the lowest risk course of action. Taylor seemed to support his colleagues, arguing that our strength in Berlin, our strength anywhere in the world, is our credibility. The chiefs, however, suspected that Taylor did not really share their views and doubted that he was faithfully representing their position during XCOM deliberations. The JCS concerns were well-founded. Taylor had distanced himself from the JCS position. On October 27th, 3 days after the naval quarantine of Cuba was in place, Taylor again presented the chief's recommendation for airstrikes, followed by a ground invasion. Robert Kennedy, whose close friend Taylor had become, remarked sarcastically, "That was a surprise." After the laughter subsided, the meeting continued without further reference to the JCS position. Taylor later gave his personal view, which was that forces should remain ready to invade, but the president make no advance decision on that. He expressed support for continuing the blockade as the first step in McNamara's proposed campaign of pressure aimed at coercing Khrushchev into withdrawing the missiles. In combination with Robert F. Kennedy's secret negotiations with the Soviet ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin, during which he discussed a quid pro quo arrangement involving the withdrawal of U.S. Jupiter missiles from Turkey, McNamara's plan for gradually intensifying military pressure, or turning the screw on the Soviets, seemed to produce the desired result. The Soviets agreed to withdraw the missiles in exchange for a U.S. promise not to invade Cuba and a secret pledge to remove American intermediate-range missiles from Turkey. After the crisis, President Kennedy told Arthur Schlesinger Jr., a historian and White House aide, that it was lucky for us that Robert McNamara was at the helm in the Pentagon. Although Kennedy was pleased with McNamara, the deliberations increased his frustration with his military advisors. The crisis ended with Kennedy thinking that the Joint Chiefs were mad in their insistence on the use of military force. On November 15, 1962, while discussing the JCS performance during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy vowed that the first advice I'm going to give my successor is to watch the generals and to avoid feeling that just because they were military men, their opinions on military matters were worth a damn. The chief's persistence in recommending a full-scale attack appeared insensitive to political constraints and the dangers of nuclear confrontation with the Soviet Union. The president's scorn, however, stemmed in part from a fundamental conflict in goals and objectives. He and his civilian advisors sought the more limited objective of removing the missiles, whereas the chiefs viewed the missile crisis as an opportunity to satisfy the objectives of Operation Mongoose. McNamara had charged the chiefs with planning for military action to rid Cuba of Castro, and although the president had no intention of invading Cuba, he continued to encourage the JCS planning efforts. To prevent the chiefs from complaining to his political opponents that he was soft on Castro and the Soviets, Kennedy preserved the impression that he was willing to consider overwhelming military intervention. Without a common understanding of the objective of military force, or of the limitations that the president considered necessary to avoid escalation, the JCS continued to recommend actions that Kennedy privately regarded as extreme. The divergent civilian and military views on American objectives during the Cuban Missile Crisis foreshadowed what would become a major obstacle to the development of a strategy for the Vietnam War. Despite having declared victory in the missile crisis, the president was concerned that concessions to the Soviets would make him vulnerable to charges of appeasement and weakness. He kept secret his agreement to remove American missiles from Turkey and told reporters to downplay the extent of the American victory. The president feared that boasts from Washington would incite the Soviet leader to reveal the missile bargain made without consultation with NATO or the Turks. Although the president could rely on McNamara to tell the Congress that there was absolutely no connection between the removal of U.S. missiles from Turkey and the resolution of the missile crisis, the JCS posed a special problem. To keep the chiefs on the team, Kennedy again invited them to the White House, where he lauded their advice and performance during the crisis. Recognizing the duplicitous nature of the president's praise, Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Anderson remarked to his colleagues, "We have been had." Air Force Chief LeMay considered the missile trade and the fact that Soviet troops and non-nuclear weapons remained in Cuba the greatest defeat in our history. Air Force Major William Y. Smith of General Taylor's personal staff recalled that the missile crisis left relations between the president's civilian and military advisors more frayed than ever. The missile crisis emboldened Secretary of Defense McNamara in the realm of strategic planning and enhanced his reputation as a level-headed advisor. As one of Taylor's White House staffers noted in February, the defense secretary was already getting away from what was perhaps an early preoccupation with counting noses and beans, and had become more assertive in the area of military strategy and operations. McNamara had gained confidence in these areas and no longer felt as though he needed military advice in developing strategic options. Suppressing the critical role of the missile trade-off in ending the crisis, he pointed to his military program of increasing pressure on the Soviet Union through overflights, mobilization, menacing troop deployments, and the blockade. In a 1987 interview, McNamara admitted that he had been a novice in the area of strategy when he took over as Secretary of Defense. He surrounded himself with people who knew a hell of a lot more than he did about national security issues and learned from them. He was a good student, however, and by the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, his views were pretty well fixed and hadn't changed to this day. McNamara was proud of what he portrayed as a personal triumph during the Cuban Missile Crisis. When he turned his attention to Southeast Asia, he exuded confidence that he had gained in the Caribbean. The defense secretary was determined to remove obstacles that might prevent him from assuming the role of chief strategist in the Pentagon. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, McNamara kept tight control over the ships, submarines, and aircraft, enforcing the quarantine around Cuba to ensure that the demonstration of American resolve sent the proper message to the Soviets. He literally lived in the Pentagon between October 16th and 27th because he feared that the military might not understand that this was a communications exercise, not a military operation. Admiral Anderson resented McNamara's intrusion into what he regarded as the Navy's responsibility and area of expertise. In Flag Plot, the Naval Operations Room, Anderson became irritated with McNamara's specific instructions on how to run the blockade. The admiral told McNamara that the Navy had been conducting blockades since the days of John Paul Jones and suggested that the defense secretary return to his office and let the Navy run the operation. McNamara rose from his chair and retorted that the operation was not a blockade, but a means of communication between Kennedy and Khrushchev, and ordered the admiral not to use force without his express permission. After demanding that Anderson acknowledge his command, McNamara left. The secretary, who had previously clashed with the recalcitrant admiral over the development of the TFX fighter and other defense issues, concluded that Anderson had left him with no option other than to have the admiral removed from the Joint Chiefs. Taylor supported McNamara in the altercation. To prevent Anderson from criticizing the administration after his retirement, President Kennedy waited until the first two-year term as Chief of Naval Operations expired, and then offered him the ambassadorship to Portugal. A few months after the Cuban Missile Crisis, Anderson left the naval service for the relative seclusion of the Iberian Peninsula. To control military operations in times of crisis, the president and the defense secretary would need men on the JCS who would permit civilian oversight in areas that had been previously regarded as sacrosanct and free from civilian interference. Kennedy had effected the early replacement of the JCS chairman, the Army Chief of Staff, and the Chief of Naval Operations. He wanted to sack LeMay at the same time as Anderson, but McNamara warned that two simultaneous removals would be one too many. The desire to control military operations more closely at the civilian level in the Office of the Secretary of Defense and in the White House coincided with advances in communications technology that made possible the detailed monitoring of military activities in faraway theaters. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, communications equipment established in the White House after the Bay of Pigs incident allowed the president to monitor and control military operations from his desk in the Oval Office. The Defense Department installed high-volume communications and data displays to let the White House Situation Room monitor closely the most technical aspects of military deployments and activities. Rather than give the military the mission to enforce the blockade, McNamara and the president orchestrated the specific activities of U.S. ships. the Cuban Missile Crisis was the best known of the Cold War flare-ups that dominated the beginning of the Kennedy administration. The Cuban Crisis of 1962 and the Berlin Crisis of 1961, during which the Soviet Union began to build the Berlin Wall and threatened to close off Western access to the divided city, were direct confrontations between the two superpowers. In 1961, however, Soviet Premier Khrushchev announced a subtler form of conflict between his bloc and the West. He declared his support for communist insurgents fighting wars of national liberation in the countries of the developing world. The crisis in Laos in 1961 and the Congo from 1961 to 1963, during which the United States, in cooperation with the United Nations, sent a military mission to prevent Soviet-supported insurgents from toppling a feeble national government, seemed to confirm his declaration. After President Kennedy was forced to accept a compromise settlement in Laos, his interest in a strategy to counter communist insurgencies in Southeast Asia and elsewhere was heightened. The president read everything he could on the subject of power wars and worked hard to gain a conceptual grasp of how best to meet this challenge. Kennedy told the graduating cadets of the West Point class of 1962, "If freedom is to be saved, we need a whole new kind of strategy, a wholly different kind of force, and a wholly different kind of training and commitment." Despite the president's interest in this perceived threat to freedom, Kennedy had not developed a clear concept of how to combat communist-sponsored insurgencies. Major William Y. Smith observed at the time that there existed a lack of clarity in counterinsurgency doctrine and a lack of coordination between agencies. South Vietnam had become the American testbed for counterinsurgency programs and techniques, and the Kennedy administration had dramatically increased economic and military aid to the American-backed government in Saigon. By the summer of 1963, 16,500 military advisors were in South Vietnam. Although Vietnam remained until 1963 a national security concern of tertiary interest, the U.S. imperative to contain communism impelled American involvement in what would otherwise have been considered an insignificant place, unworthy of even the most cursory policy deliberations. Before World War II, America had demonstrated no interest in Vietnam, a narrow, 1,000-mile-long stretch of land on the Asian Rim under the domination, along with Cambodia and Laos, of French colonialism. The U.S. government took notice, however, when Japanese troops landed there in 1940. Vietnam was important to the Japanese for access to China and as a stepping stone toward the oil-rich Dutch East Indies. Although native nationalists in Southeast Asia initially rallied to Japan, it soon became apparent to most of the Vietnamese people that the Japanese had come to oppress them and strip their land of food and resources. Millions would starve, while the Japanese exported rice to their home islands. Ho Chi Minh, a Vietnamese patriot who had traveled the globe and was then living in Moscow, recognized that welcoming the Japanese as liberators was tantamount to driving the tiger out the front door while letting the wolf in through the back. In 1941, Ho, disguised as a Chinese journalist, left Moscow and returned to his native land for the first time in 30 years. He appealed to Vietnamese nationalists and helped form and lead a resistance movement against the Japanese. Communist in ideology, Ho's Viet Minh was the strongest of the nationalist groups seeking independence. In August 1945, after the defeat of Japan, the Viet Minh filled the power vacuum, and on September 2nd, Ho declared Vietnam's independence. Before his death, President Franklin D. Roosevelt had made self-determination part of his vision for the post-war world. Under the tutelage or trusteeship of the West, the Vietnamese and other brown people of the East would gradually gain their independence. After World War II, Roosevelt's successor, Harry S. Truman, rejected trusteeship in favor of conciliating France and Europe. Despite Ho's attempts to emphasize his nationalistic aims over his communist predilections, the United States watched passively as France moved to reclaim Indochina, first in the South, then in the North. In mid-December 1946, increasing tension between the French and Vietnamese nationalists gave way to direct military conflict, with the Viet Minh leading the effort against the French. As the First Indochina War began, the fear of global communism, along with U.S. loyalty to its European allies, impelled American support for the French. U.S. approval of French aims in Indochina was already an important element of building a European alliance against the communist threat to Western Europe. At the end of the 1940s, against the backdrop of the Iron Curtain's descent over Europe, the Soviet Union's successful explosion of an atomic device, and the communist victory in China, the Truman administration concluded that Ho was part of a Soviet-sponsored, monolithic communist movement. The French, meanwhile, attempted to counter Ho's popularity and curry favor with the United States by creating a veneer of independence for Vietnam under Emperor Bao Dai's puppet government. Contrasts between the emperor and his competitor to the north were striking. Ho seemed to personify Vietnam's experience with French colonialism. His time in the West had left a deep impression on him, yet he retained his native identity and peasant appearance. He had studied and appropriated the ideas that had sparked revolutions in America and France in the 18th century, as well as in Russia in 1917. Ho's reputation as a learned ascetic devoted to the Vietnamese people contrasted with Bao Dai's opulent affectations, philandering, and record of collaboration with the French and Japanese. Indeed, pro-French intentions were obvious. Bao Dai himself remarked, "What they call a Bao Dai solution turns out to be just a French solution." Although some American officials predicted that the regime would collapse, Washington recognized Bao Dai's government in 1950 and began actively supporting the French in the war against the Viet Minh. The outbreak of the Korean War in June highlighted the importance of containing communism in Asia. American military and economic aid for the French increased. Despite growing American support, the French effort in Vietnam faltered. The elusive, determined, and increasingly competent Viet Minh, with the aid of equipment and supplies from communist China, inflicted a series of defeats on the French. By 1952, French casualties in the war had exceeded 90,000. The Viet Minh had lost even greater numbers of men, but by 1953 it was clear that they could outlast the French. The French people had begun to call the seemingly interminable conflict in the faraway forests and jungles of Indochina the Dirty War. In early 1952, Truman's National Security Council postulated that the loss of any of the countries of Southeast Asia to communist aggression would have critical psychological, political, and economic consequences. The objective of U.S. policy in the region was to prevent countries from passing into the communist orbit and to assist them to develop will and ability to resist communism from within and without. It was the first clear articulation of the domino theory, the enduring rationale for fighting communism in Southeast Asia. In 1953, as he sought to fulfill his election year promise to end the stalemated and unpopular Korean War, President Dwight D. Eisenhower continued and expanded upon the Truman administration's support for the French in Indochina. During the first months of 1954, the French military situation in Indochina grew desperate. When the French attempted to lure their enemy into a conventional confrontation, the Viet Minh surrounded their garrison at Dien Bien Phu. By the end of March, it appeared as if only American military intervention could save them. When Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Admiral Arthur Radford and Air Force Chief of Staff Nathan Twining advocated airstrikes in support of the beleaguered French forces, Army Chief of Staff Matthew Ridgway dissented, and Marine Corps Commandant Lemuel Shepard supported him, citing, "No significant promise for success. Predictions of an uncontrollable, futile military commitment in Vietnam, combined with British reluctance and Franco-American difficulties to outweigh arguments for intervention." In April 1954, Eisenhower, unwilling to intervene without allies and associates in a war that would absorb our troops by the division, denied a French request for direct military support. Viet Minh forces overran the French garrison on May 7th. Only 73 of the more than 15,000 men at Dien Bien Phu escaped. Viet Minh losses were estimated at 25,000. Ho, however, had told a French visitor at the outset of the conflict, "You can kill 10 of my men for every one I kill of yours. But even at those odds, you will lose and I will win." The end for the French signaled a new beginning for the United States. In July 1954, the United States gave its oral endorsement to the Geneva Accords, which temporarily ended the hostilities in Vietnam. The agreement temporarily partitioned Vietnam into North and South, limited the introduction of foreign troops into the region, and called for general elections to unify the country by July 1956. During the Geneva Conference, Bao Dai appointed Ngo Dinh Diem, then living in Paris, as prime minister. As a young man, Diem had pursued a career as a politician and bureaucrat until he became frustrated with French colonial rule. He had long advocated Vietnamese independence, but rejected Ho's communist vision. In 1945, the Viet Minh held Diem prisoner for 6 months until, after a brief meeting with Ho, he was released. While in captivity, Diem learned that the Viet Minh had murdered one of his five brothers, Coy, and Coy's son. A bachelor and devout Catholic, Diem left Vietnam and spent 2 years at the Mary Knoll Seminary in Lakewood, New Jersey, before moving to Europe in 1953. Not long after his return to Vietnam as prime minister, Diem, with the assistance of his brother, Ngo Dinh Nu, organized a referendum to oust Bao Dai. It was rigged. Diem received almost all the votes, and in several places, the ballots for Diem exceeded the number of registered voters. Despite his undemocratic practices, Ngo Dinh Diem became America's ally in the fight against communist domination in Southeast Asia. The CIA helped thwart several attempts to overthrow him, and the Eisenhower administration pumped millions of dollars in economic and military aid into South Vietnam to prop up his fledgling government. In 1956, the United States assumed full responsibility for training and equipping the Vietnamese Army and established a military assistance and advisory group, MAG, in Saigon. Meanwhile, the Eisenhower administration worked outside of the Geneva agreements to weaken Ho's North Vietnamese regime through psychological warfare and covert operations. Diem, with the approval of the U.S. government, refused to hold elections called for in the Geneva Accords, and the boundary between North and South Vietnam became another frontier that separated the free world from world communism. In the late 1950s, it appeared that Diem had worked a miracle in South Vietnam. With the aid of the CIA and Catholics who had fled the North, Diem consolidated political control. He made the cover of Time magazine, and his American sponsors celebrated the apparent progress. The appearance of success, however, belied an approaching storm. Diem's aloof political style and his religion, Catholicism was a minority faith introduced by the French, prevented him from gaining real popular support. Personal loyalty overwhelmed competence as the principal criterion for appointments to high civilian or military posts. Most important, however, Diem had failed to eliminate Viet Minh resistance. And Ho, preoccupied with economic difficulties and the consolidation of his own political power in the North, had not yet concentrated on his goal of unifying all of Vietnam under the control of Hanoi. In 1959, as Kennedy began to organize his bid for the Democratic presidential nomination, Vietnamese communists were responding to the directive of the 15th plenum of the Communist Party's Central Committee. In January, the committee had declared, "The fundamental path of development for the revolution in South Vietnam is that of violent struggle. Based on the concrete conditions and existing requirements of revolution, then, the road of violent struggle is: use the strength of the masses, with the political strength as the main factor, combined with military strength to a greater or lesser degree, depending on the situation, in order to overthrow the ruling power of the imperialist and feudalist forces and build the revolutionary power of the people." Based on the premise that the unification of Vietnam under Hanoi's rule had to be won in the minds of the people, the Vietnamese communist strategy of revolutionary war called for a shifting combination of political and military action to obtain the loyalty of the people of the South. During the 1960 presidential campaign, as Senator Kennedy and Vice President Nixon debated issues that resonated more clearly with the American electorate, the Diem government's counterinsurgency effort was intensifying against a more active Viet Cong. Although Kennedy was willing to send U.S. military advisors into South Vietnam and mount covert operations in North Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, he drew the line on U.S. combat units. The word advisor implied that the South Vietnamese would do their own fighting. The introduction of American combat units risked transforming the war into an American war, raising the specter of high U.S. casualties and fomenting congressional and public debate over administration policy. On November 11, 1961, President Kennedy decided to commit U.S. advisors to South Vietnam in excess of the number permitted in the Geneva Accords of 1954. Kennedy believed that increased Viet Cong activity in South Vietnam and Laos justified crossing that threshold. In the following 20 months, the U.S. military presence in South Vietnam ballooned without a deliberate examination of policy options. Other issues and events, such as the civil rights movement and a series of foreign policy crises, hit closer to home and overshadowed the increasing U.S. involvement in Vietnam. Although U.S. advisors were fighting with South Vietnamese units and U.S. pilots were flying combat missions in South Vietnam, Kennedy denied that Americans were involved in combat, and Vietnam attracted little public or congressional attention. Vietnam was far from front page news, and Americans still believed that their government told them the truth. It seemed by early 1963 that the tripling of the American advisory effort during the previous year had stabilized the situation in Vietnam. A year before, the Diem government had initiated the Strategic Hamlet Program, involving the consolidation of much of the South Vietnamese rural populace into villages in which they theoretically remained insulated and secure from Viet Cong activities and influence. Despite problems of mismanagement, the program, in combination with increased American military support, caused the Viet Cong and their North Vietnamese sponsors considerable consternation. American visitors to South Vietnam returned with optimistic reports. After a January visit to Vietnam, Earl Wheeler, by now Army Chief of Staff, reported, "We are winning slowly on the present thrust," and concluded that there was no compelling reason to change the current policy. Periodic reports on the situation in South Vietnam from General Paul D. Harkins, commander of Military Assistance Command Vietnam, or MACV, were similarly optimistic. The outbreak of Buddhist uprisings in May 1963 against the government of the Catholic Diem and Diem's brutal repression of the revolt militated against these sanguine assessments. The United States failed to dissuade Diem and his brother, Ngo Dinh Nguyen, the head of the secret police, from taking drastic action against the Buddhists. On June 11th, the first self-immolation by a Buddhist occurred. In August, news units invaded the main pagodas of Saigon, arrested bonzes, Buddhist clergymen, and inflicted great damage on the holy places. Vietnam hit the front pages of America's newspapers. Officials within the Kennedy administration grew increasingly concerned as a significant portion of the South Vietnamese populace began to connect American support for the government with Nguyen's obdurate callousness. The new ambassador to South Vietnam, Henry Cabot Lodge, cabled Secretary Rusk to inform him that, "We have been hearing increasing comments from the Vietnamese from many walks of life criticizing us to the effect that events of the past several days would not have been possible without U.S. equipment and asking why the U.S. refrains from stopping the brutality." Lodge went on to observe that many Vietnamese implied or stated overtly that the Diem government and his family must go. William Bundy, McGeorge's older brother and McNamara's Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, recalled that after mid-August 1963, the Kennedy administration became more preoccupied with Vietnam than at any previous time. For several weeks, the president and his advisors had been debating options concerning the future of the Diem government. The JCS had agreed with former Ambassador Frederick Nolting that there was no viable alternative to Diem, and were unified in their position that the United States should do nothing to engineer a change in government in South Vietnam. Members of Kennedy's inner circle, however, including Roger Hilsman, the Democratic Party's elder statesman, Averill Harriman, and Michael Forrestal, thought that getting rid of Diem was the only alternative. True to a well-established pattern among members of the Kennedy administration, these men worked surreptitiously to advance their own solution to the problem. Hilsman teletyped a draft cable to the president's Cape Cod home that would instruct Ambassador Lodge to give Diem's and Nguyen's military opponents direct support in an effort to replace them with the best military and political personalities available. Because Hilsman sent the cable on a weekend, during which the president's principal advisors were out of Washington, Kennedy approved its contents without considering fully its potential consequences. Initial contacts with South Vietnamese generals revealed that there was little in-country backing for an anti-Diem coup. In a meeting with the president on August 27th, Nolting told Kennedy and his advisors that military support for a coup did not now exist. Several days later, Hilsman reported that contacts with two generals revealed less support than anticipated. Lodge confirmed the lack of support for the coup within the South Vietnamese military, but cabled Rusk that "we are now launched on a course from which there is no respectable turning back, the overthrow of the Diem government." The question of how involved the United States should become in inciting Diem's ouster incited heated debate in Washington. Both Taylor and McNamara voiced objections, but the president seemed unable to make a decision. Meanwhile, Ambassador Lodge, convinced that Diem had to go, continued to explore the possibilities of a coup. Rusk blamed Diem's ineptitude and callous treatment of the Buddhists for the reversal of the favorable developments of the first 6 months of this year, when we were beginning to feel that a corner had been turned and that we would anticipate a successful conclusion. He gave Lodge a free hand as long as the ambassador minimized the appearance of collusion with the generals. Certain that the ship of state in Vietnam was slowly sinking, Lodge saw a drastic change in government as the only answer to the difficulties in South Vietnam. With plans to orchestrate a coup already well underway in Saigon, President Kennedy sent Taylor and Robert McNamara to Vietnam from September 23rd to October 2nd to produce the best possible on-the-spot appraisal of the military and paramilitary effort to defeat the Viet Cong. Members of the McNamara-Taylor mission were split between those agreeing with General Harkin's optimistic reports of progress and others who viewed the situation in South Vietnam more skeptically. Because the report had to be acceptable to the whole team and was prepared in a hurried manner, it was rife with contradictions and failed to reach useful conclusions. It acknowledged the problem of unrest in the cities, for example, but watered down the assessment by noting that considerable progress had been made in the countryside. To place additional pressure on Diem and give the American people the impression that the South Vietnamese were gaining the upper hand against the Viet Cong, Kennedy publicly announced a decision to withdraw 1,000 U.S. advisors from South Vietnam by Christmas. At the same time, he suggested that all American military advisors would be out of Vietnam by the end of 1965. The president also instructed Lodge to suspend portions of American aid to dissuade Diem from committing further acts of violence against the Buddhists. Kennedy failed to establish a clear policy toward the Diem government. McNamara and Taylor had recommended not encouraging a coup. Referring to his initial cable authorizing Lodge to conspire against Diem, Kennedy told George Ball on October 4th, "We fucked that up." Despite his misgivings, however, Kennedy sent contradictory signals to Lodge, and the ambassador continued to undermine the South Vietnamese regime. On October 6th, the president instructed Lodge to take no initiative to give any active, covert encouragement to a coup. The next day, however, Lodge received instructions not to thwart a change of government to a new regime, if the alternative appeared viable. On October 29th, the president met with his advisors to discuss Diem's fate. Taylor expressed frustration that Lodge was acting without the counsel of Harkins, who remained unaware of what the embassy and the CIA were doing. He felt that members of the administration were watching the coup preparations as if they were a football game. Taylor, expressing the JCS view, warned that Diem's ouster would impede the war effort. McCone and Robert Kennedy voiced support for Taylor's position. Rusk, Harriman, Hilsman, and Forrestal, however, recommended going forward with the coup. The president seemed ambivalent. Advice from his brother and Taylor almost swayed him, but at the end of the meeting, Kennedy declared indecisively that he would discourage a coup only if Lodge, on whom he depended to generate Republican support for his policy, shared Taylor's and Robert Kennedy's misgivings. On October 31st, McGeorge Bundy instructed Lodge that once a coup under responsible leadership has begun, it is in the interest of the U.S. government that it should succeed. Diem's fate was sealed. The coup began just after noon, Saigon time, on November 1st, and the generals notified their American co-conspirators shortly thereafter. Several hours later, Diem called Ambassador Lodge, wanting to know the attitude of the U.S. government. Lodge pleaded ignorance and patronized the South Vietnamese leader with compliments on his courage and great contributions to his country. Diem hung up after telling the ambassador that he would try to reestablish order. November 1963 marked a turning point in the Vietnam War. The U.S. role in fomenting a change in the South Vietnamese government saddled the United States with responsibility for its successor. Instability in the South presented the Viet Cong and their North Vietnamese sponsors with an opportunity to exploit, and the deteriorating situation forced the United States to consider deepening its involvement in what had become a new war. An assassin's bullet, however, would bequeath those decisions to John Kennedy's vice president, Lyndon Johnson. Along with the question of what to do about Vietnam, Lyndon Johnson inherited Kennedy's closest advisors, and the relationships that had developed among them. The relationship between the JCS and those to whom they provided military advice had become one of deep distrust. The chairman, selected for his personal loyalty to the president, had forged a closer relationship with the Secretary of Defense than the one he enjoyed with his military colleagues. McNamara, emboldened in the realm of strategic planning, was poised to become the president's dominant advisor on military affairs. Convinced that military advice based on the objective of achieving victory was outmoded, even dangerous, he would use his talent for analysis and the experience of the Cuban Missile Crisis to develop a new concept for the use of American military power. John Kennedy bequeathed to Lyndon Johnson an advisory system that limited real influence to his inner circle and treated others, particularly the Joint Chiefs of Staff, more like a source of potential opposition than of useful advice. Chapter 3, New War, New Leader, November 1963 to January 1964. The president is not a shapeless organism in a flood of novelties, but a man with a memory in a system with a history. James David Barber, The Presidential Character. At 3 o'clock a.m. on November 1, 1963, a phone call from the National Military Command Center at the Pentagon awoke JCS Chairman Taylor and informed him that the anticipated coup against South Vietnamese President Ngo Dinh Diem and his brother Ngo Dinh Nu had begun about noon Saigon time. Taylor dressed quickly and left his home at Fort Myer, Virginia, for the Pentagon. His trusted aide, Lieutenant Colonel Bernard W. Rogers, met him at the office. Rogers had organized the incoming cables concerning the ZM coup. Taylor read them before meeting with the Joint Chiefs to discuss the consequences of events unfolding in South Vietnam. Taylor's relationship with the Chiefs was mixed. He had spent a great deal of his time trying to reconcile differences of opinion between himself and Air Force Chief of Staff Curtis LeMay, whom he had antagonized with forceful attacks on the Air Force in Taylor's book, The Uncertain Trumpet. Taylor was not the only one who disagreed with LeMay's opinions, however. The general's impassioned recommendations of bombing as the definitive solution to military problems had earned him a reputation as a loose cannon. Deputy Secretary of Defense Gilpatrick told one of his assistants that President Kennedy has kind of a fit when you mention LeMay. However, LeMay's combat and command records would have made removing him from the JCS controversial. When his first two-year term came to an end, Kennedy, rather than risk opposition from LeMay's supporters in Congress, extended his appointment for only 1 year, sending the general a clear message. Taylor had recently persuaded LeMay to support the September 1963 Limited Test Ban Treaty that restricted American and Soviet nuclear testing to underground explosions. They had come to agreement, however, at the price of congeniality. LeMay was unable to conceal his animosity for Taylor and often felt like letting him have one. The bad feelings were mutual. Taylor regarded LeMay as politically naive and believed that his appointment as Air Force Chief of Staff had been a big mistake. Traditional seating protocol at JCS meetings put LeMay at Taylor's immediate right. LeMay's bushy eyebrows, sagging jowls, and jutting jaw advertised an irascible personality. Aware of Taylor's aversion to tobacco smoke, he hung his ever-present long dark cigar out of the left side of his mouth and intentionally puffed the thick smoke in Taylor's direction. Both men were hard of hearing, and the resulting misunderstandings worsened the tension between them. Seated to LeMay's right at the short end of the table was Marine Corps Commandant David Shoup, the last remaining holdover from the Eisenhower administration. Before Taylor became chairman, the often profane, poker-playing Shoup had grown frustrated because Taylor's predecessor, General Lemnitzer, never directly questioned Secretary McNamara's controversial methods. Shoup, who had received the Medal of Honor for heroism on the Pacific island of Tarawa in World War II, planned to retire in January 1964 after a distinguished career. Considering his position on the Joint Chiefs tedious, the Commandant gave priority to his duties as head of the Marine Corps. Although he attended JCS meetings only when issues directly affected the Corps, Vietnam was a subject on which the General possessed strong opinions. A trip to South Vietnam in 1962 confirmed his abiding conviction that the United States should not, under any circumstances, get involved in land warfare in Southeast Asia. Disagreements among the chiefs often reflected differences in their philosophies of war. LeMay, for example, felt that the United States should respond to security threats with massive retaliation from the air, whereas Shoup was against using military force at all unless U.S. vital interests were at stake. Shoup based his philosophy on practical experience. To him, the lesson of Korea was that the United States was not adept at fighting protracted limited wars. In contrast to both of them, Taylor believed that the United States could take military action in Southeast Asia short of committing to war, and that fighting limited wars was essential to a strategy of flexible response, which would avoid the extremes, nuclear war or buckling to communist aggression. Accordingly, he expressed frustration with those like Shoup and LeMay, who refused for various reasons to support the shift in national security strategy to Taylor's concept of flexible response. In Taylor's view, LeMay typified the Air Force's blind preoccupation with the preponderant use of air power. Taylor thought that Shoup and others, who refused on principle to fight on the Asian mainland, overemphasized the country's domestic political reaction to the Korean War and had an American penchant for simple solutions to complex problems. The Navy stayed aloof from the debate because the outcome of the discussion was less consequential for the Navy than for the Air Force or Army. A fixation on limited war was likely to cut into the Air Force's strategic nuclear force, just as Eisenhower's policy of massive retaliation had strengthened it at the Army's expense. The Navy, however, had succeeded in carving out a role independent from the contest. Admiral David MacDonald, like the chiefs of naval operations before him, was interested primarily in maintaining America's global dominance at sea. Although the Navy was still angry over McNamara's removal of Anderson as chief of naval operations, his replacement, Admiral MacDonald, had fared well during the Kennedy administration. In April 1963, MacDonald was selected over 28 more senior vice admirals for promotion to four-star rank and given command of all U.S. naval forces in the European theater of operations. MacDonald had been in his new command less than 1 month when President Kennedy announced that he would appoint him chief of naval operations. MacDonald was more adept politically than Anderson and therefore well-suited to maintain the Navy's bargaining power within the government. He was not reluctant to make compromises to further the Navy's interest. When asked to expound on his personal philosophy, the admiral responded with an anecdote. "You know about the fellow who says, 'I'd rather be right than be president'? He never was president." MacDonald valued the expediency of giving in to something he knew was going to happen anyway. His tact and political sensitivity contrasted sharply with the stubbornness of LeMay, across from whom he sat. General Wheeler, the Army Chief of Staff, sat next to MacDonald and across from Taylor. Wheeler was a new type of JCS member. Unlike LeMay and Shoup, who mostly held command positions, Wheeler was primarily a staff officer who spent nearly half of his post-World War II career in Washington. Like MacDonald, Wheeler was particularly adept at working within the Washington bureaucratic maze and was talented at creating compromises between parties otherwise disinclined to reconcile their differences. Taylor recommended to the administration that Wheeler be appointed Army Chief of Staff and knew that he could be counted on for his loyalty and support. When in January 1963, at the village of Op Bac, the South Vietnamese Army suffered a costly defeat at the hands of a smaller Viet Cong force, Taylor sent Wheeler to Vietnam to investigate. Wheeler, who recognized that a negative assessment of South Vietnamese fighting ability might call into question the counterinsurgency effort for which Taylor had been largely responsible, helped damp down the controversy over the battle. Whatever their differences, the chiefs had been united in their opposition to the Diem coup. Although Diem had handled the Buddhists roughly and the brutality of his brother Nhu was disquieting, the military officers viewed the war against the Viet Cong as the major problem in South Vietnam and thought that engineering a change in government after supporting Diem for so long would invalidate the U.S. effort in Vietnam. The chiefs also did not think that anyone was capable of taking Diem's place. They resented the administration's disregard for their advice and the secrecy under which the coup plotting had been carried out, referring to the coup scornfully as the Asian Bay of Pigs. Nonetheless, the coup gave the chiefs time to consider the situation in South Vietnam. Reports brought into the meeting confirmed that a group of generals headed by Duong Van Big Min, with support from the Saigon garrison, had attacked the presidential palace. When the Joint Chiefs began to discuss the probable character of Min's leadership, one of them sarcastically remarked that other than being weak, dumb, and lazy, Min was well qualified for the South Vietnamese presidency. The Chiefs agreed that the situation in Vietnam was deteriorating. The optimism of early 1963 was gone as the Chiefs contemplated the effect that the coup would have on the counterinsurgency effort. As the JCS meeting ended, the coup was still in progress. Later that morning, Kennedy learned Diem's and Nhu's fate. An aide informed the president that the former U.S. allies in the fight against communism lay dead in the back of an American-made armored personnel carrier, with bound hands and execution-style bullet wounds in the backs of their heads. The president was shocked. He had not realized that his failure to give clear instructions to Ambassador Lodge would have such unpleasant consequences halfway around the world. Yet, he felt no remorse for the death of the brothers. By November 2nd, Kennedy turned his thoughts to ensuring stability in South Vietnam and explaining the affair to the American people. Kennedy made it clear that deposing Diem was purely pragmatic. His immediate concern was that the new government have the will and capability to continue the fight against the Viet Cong. Afraid that the United States might lose its entire position in Southeast Asia overnight, he told his advisors that we need an effective government more than a pretty government. McNamara informed the president that U.S. forces were steaming toward Vietnam to deter the Viet Cong from taking advantage of the turmoil in Saigon. For his part, McGeorge Bundy was relieved that the coup had finally been accomplished. He told the president and his closest advisors